This is a Lip Media podcast.
Feminism, 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 feminism ruins everything.
It's a feminist podcast.
Hello and welcome to Feminism Ruins Everything. We are the feminist podcast where we give critiques to movies, musicals, and pop culture phenomena and potentially ruin them.
Potentially.
We'd like to acknowledge that today we are meeting and recording on stolen Kaurna land, and we'd like to pay our respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge that sovereignty of this land was never ceded. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Today, I'm really excited because we are discussing the seminal teen comedy classic,
Ten Things I Hate About You.
We got baby Heath Ledger, we got baby Joseph Gordon-Levitt, we got baby Julia Stiles, we got baby that guy from Numbers, everybody's so little and adorable, and this movie is great.
It's so good.
It's, like, it's fucking phenomenal.
Interestingly, I reckon I'd seen this movie, like, once before, and then we watched it again yesterday, and I didn't have much recollection of what I thought about the film the one time that I'd seen it previously. Like, I was 5 when it came out. I wasn't quite the prime demographic for, like, teenage rom-coms in in 99. I was a bit busy, like, starting school.
I was busy emigrating to Australia.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So I was distracted in other ways.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
You were also, like, 7.
That too.
Yeah. So, again,
Not the demographic.
Yeah. But we rewatched it yesterday, and holy shit, this movie is good.
It's so good.
And interestingly, Ellis and I just had a revelation, and we were like, it all makes sense.
So 10 Things I Hate About You was written by Kirsten Smith and Karen McCullough, who wrote Legally Blonde.
Those of you familiar with our past episodes will be aware that we both are obsessed with Legally Blonde, but, like, Ellis more so.
It makes so much sense why I like this movie, because it's just, those writers are great.
Mm. Before we get into the feminist elements of it, I want to give, like, a quick rundown of all the stuff that's good that isn't feminist. let's alternate.
Okay, great.
So, I love the 90s aesthetic. Like, I recognize that it was just what was cool in the 90s, but retrospectively, it's like, this is the most 90s thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, the fashion, the even just the opening credits and, like, the text of the opening credits.
Like, going off of
the
that.
The eyebrows.
The music in this film.
Lack thereof eyebrows.
The music in this film is awesome. We open with One Week by the Bare Naked Ladies.
What did you say?
I have no idea. One Week by the Bare Naked Ladies, BNL, and that kind of sets the tone for the music for the rest of the film, and it's all great.
It slaps.
It's so good.
Did I use that right?
I wouldn't know.
Young people? Gen Z, can you tell me if I said it slaps correctly?
I can barely get around. It's a bop, so.
Oh, no, I fully embrace that
one.
Yeah,
you've embraced the bop.
Other non-feminist things that I love. Just all of the physical comedy. There are so many things where people, like, fall off something, or somebody gets hurt or trips over and
rides a motorbike over a hill,
gets shot by an arrow in the butt. Like, not stuff that normally appeals to my sense of humor, but for some reason it's just done so well that I find it hilarious.
My heart cannot help but be warmed by Heath Ledger singing "Can't Take My Eyes Off of You" with the marching band and
getting chased by security.
Yeah,
another excellent physical,
brilliant
gag.
Physical comedy. I mean, all the acting in this film is so good, and is, like, all these really talented people, kind of at the beginning of their careers.
Yeah,
and they've all kind of gone on to do a lot of things.
Baby Joseph Gordon-Levitt has my heart.
He's so cute. So cute.
You know what? I could even say that I, Joseph Gordon, love it.
And that's all we have time for here on Feminism Ruins Everything.
Thank you so much. That's been the episode. I can't take credit for that. My friend Sam says that all the time. He's like, right. I love it. I, Joseph Gordon, love it. Hi, Sam, if you're listening.
But on top of all of this, what the film has at its core is a really solid script
and
some really feminist values.
Yeah. I mean, it helps with the arc of your script and the various hijinks when it's based off of a Shakespearean comedy.
Yes. This is a modern adaptation of The Taming of the Shrew, which I don't know too much about, except that it was the basis for 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know very much about Twelfth Night other than it's the basis of She's the Man, which is another really great film that I really like and think we should do an episode on as well, if only for an excuse for me to rewatch it.
I've never seen it. So
it's so good.
Let's give it a shot.
It's Amanda Bynes pretending to be a boy.
Oh, Amanda Bynes.
Like, Amanda Bynes' heyday. I miss her. I hope she's well. I'm sending her positive energy.
I hope she's well as well. She had a bit of a revival with, like, Hairspray and then kind of beat it off a bit. But
no, I think she had, like, a full mental breakdown.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Oh, I did not know
that. I think her mental health, like, absolutely spiraled.
Oh, I'm really...
That's
really
why sad. I was sending her, like, positive energy, okay, that I hope she's, like, doing okay.
I hope she's doing okay as well.
Yeah. Love you, Amanda Bynes.
If you're listening. She never misses these.
She's our number one listener.
But not a patron. Interesting. Thanks, Amanda.
Hit us up on Patreon.
We're off topic.
Million Dollars off topic?
Shocker.
To dive into the feminist critique or feminist discussion of this film, one of the biggest takeaways for me is the representation of feminism itself. And it almost feels to me like a little bit of a time capsule that this film is like, this is how broader society viewed feminism in the 90s, and like, look how far we've come. Because, I mean, maybe it's because I'm in the thick of it that I feel this, but to me, in 2020, feminism feels quite mainstream.
Yeah.
And it feels quite normalized, whereas I think that in 1999, when this film came out, it was definitely more of a fringe.
It was a countercultural kind of thing. And I think it's kind of exemplified with the character of Bianca, Kat's sister, kind of being like, well, why can't you be normal? And just like wanting to kind of go with the flow, whereas Kat is like an outspoken hardcore feminist.
Yeah.
And is seen as very much othered.
Yeah, so Kat is our leading lady, played by Julia Stiles. Stiles, plural?
Yes.
Yeah. Stiles. I keep wanting to call her Julia Style. I don't know why.
Because she has it.
All right, we've each had one really bad joke. So we can move on now. Yeah, so I guess that it's interesting that I kind of was on the fence for a little while about what position the film was taking, because I was like, because everyone seems to be admonishing her for her feminist values, or at least her outspoken nature and the fact that she doesn't want to fit into high school culture.
Yeah.
And on one hand, that seems to be the view taken by everyone in the film except her, at least for the first like 15, 20 minutes or so. But at the same time, like, she's the heroine of the film. Like, she's the leading lady. She's the protagonist. So, and I think potentially, to use your and my favorite phrase, Ellis Dolan, it's almost like we are setting up expectations to subvert them.
Yeah.
In that, to start with, you're kind of meant to be like, oh, maybe everyone has a bit of a point. Like, she's a bit wacko for being into this kind of radical movement of like women having rights. but then the further into the film we go, the more you get on board with her and the more you come to appreciate her and like see why her worldview and how her worldview was shaped. And then by the end, you're like, is it lulling you into a false sense of security to by the end of it be like,
heinous bitch.
Fuck yeah, I'm a feminist. Like, Kat, what a queen.
Well, I also think that it's like the perception of her changes, not only for the audience, but for other characters in the film. Like, the more time that Patrick spends with her, the more his perception of her changes. The more that Bianca kind of gets to know her sister, the more that baby Joseph Gordon-Levitt gets to know her.
Baby Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
He just, you know, like, she starts kind of opening up a little bit and being less defensive.
Yeah.
But everybody else around her is kind of like going, actually, no, she's not as bad as we thought or she wants us to think. And the character that kind of doesn't change that much is the villain of the piece, Joey.
Oh, I hate him.
Model Joey.
He is very handsome.
He's very handsome. I mean,
he's very pretty to look at.
So Joey is played by Andrew Keegan, and again, played very well. He really kind of sells this role.
Like, I feel like he would have had the best time being like, yeah, here's my swimwear pose. And here's my underwear pose. See the difference? It's like very subtle. I feel like that would have been such a fun scene for him to play.
Oh, yeah. I feel like everybody had a great time.
Yeah.
Looked like they were having a great time filming this.
I suppose something that I, that this film sparked in my mind and made me think about a bit was about women in general, but especially feminists, this idea that society wants you to be palatable in order to be taken seriously and not written off, I suppose, to some degree. And I think that to some extent, the really kind of stern exterior that Julia Stiles' character takes on is kind of fighting against that. Like the fact that it's like, look, I'm allowed to be my own person. I'm allowed to like what I like. I don't have to shrink myself to fit in your mold of how you think I need to be in order to be accepted by you and to be perceived as palatable by you. But at the same time, I do think we were talking a little bit before we started recording, Alice, about the fact that to some degree, that stern exterior is a bit of a defense mechanism for her as well.
She reveals that she kind of had like a negative experience in the past with Joey. And as a result of that, she decided that she wasn't going to conform and do things just because everybody else was. And that manifested in this kind of defensive showcasing of her individuality.
And let's segue into the relationship she has with Patrick. That's the name of Heath Ledger's character. I didn't hear anyone call him that until like 3/4 of the way through the film. I was like, sorry, his name's what?
I didn't hear half of what he was saying because I was too transfixed by his smile.
It's a beautiful smile.
He's a beautiful man.
He's a beautiful... Rest in peace, Heath Ledger.
Rest in peace.
So, Patrick... It's his character's name. Mim and Ellis know the name of a character? What parallel universe is this? I think the interesting thing about seeing how she opens up as their relationship moves on kind of reveals something about her character in that she, like, her defenses kind of come down a little bit and her... this defensive shield that she kind of carries around in this stern persona is kind of taken down. And you see that, you know, she does have the capacity to be warm. She does have the capacity to be affectionate. It's just that she only wants to do that on her terms. And you still see that the values that she so firmly believes in never change. Like, she...
Yeah.
She
never compromises her values or herself...
never compromises her values.
...for any reason, especially not for a man.
Yeah, and so you see constantly, like, her being like, I don't want to go to prom with you. Like, what's in it for you? Like, she doesn't want to compromise on her idea that this is, like, an outdated, problematic high school tradition just because she's fallen for this boy. Like, yeah, she's let her walls down and she has shown a more open side of her, but she's like, no, my values are still the same.
However, it is interesting that she does eventually go to the prom, but only for her sister. When she's like, I understand that this is very important to you and I want to mend this relationship that we have, so I'm going to do this for you. And also, Heath Ledger happens to be there, and that's a nice bonus.
Yeah, yeah. So I suppose the takeaway from the film that I get is the idea that you don't need to to shrink yourself to conform. You don't need to change how you interact with the world if what you're doing works for you. Like, it makes me think about the conversations about not telling women to smile and not telling people to lighten up, women especially, because how you go about the world should be on your terms, and you don't have to be perceived as more palatable or more acceptable for other people. I think that you explained it better, Ellis. We were talking about this before. How did you phrase it?
it's kind of like the issue isn't whether or not somebody has a smiley personality. The issue is when somebody says, hey, I want you to change the way that you are acting to benefit me. Like, you'd look hotter if you smiled more. The issue isn't specifically whether the person is smiling or not. It's that somebody else is like, I want you to change what you are doing to be more pleasing to me or to be more acceptable to me.
Yeah.
And I think many more intelligent people than I have phrased this well, but using the Black Lives Matter protests as an example, when Colin Kaepernick began kneeling for the national anthem, critics of that action were just like, how dare you? That is no way to protest. That is insulting. How dare you do this?
How dare you disrespect the flag and the military.
And the national anthem and whatnot. When all he was doing was kneeling on the ground peacefully to demonstrate a point. And then earlier this year, especially when the Black Lives Matter protests kind of erupted, particularly in the United States, a lot of people just like, you can't protest. Protesting is wrong. Why can't you do something more peacefully? But they tried that.
Yeah.
And you disagreed with that.
Yeah.
Which kind of revealed that the people in power will never find your way of protest acceptable. And it's kind of inherent in the act of protesting that you're doing something that they have deemed is unacceptable because you are protesting something unacceptable.
It's meant to be civil disruption.
Exactly.
To get the point across. Yeah. And so, yeah, that is, I mean, it's different in a lot of ways, but the idea that you have no control about how women lead their lives. Like,
yeah, you have no control or right to dictate how somebody carries themselves.
Yeah, like, be that in protest, be that just in how a woman participates in her everyday life.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody has to smile because you're uncomfortable at seeing a strong woman who doesn't take any of your shit.
Yeah. And we were talking about this before we started recording, that even though I recognize how important that discourse is around not telling women how to behave in society. The whole idea of not telling women to smile has never been a part of feminist discourse that has particularly resonated with me. And I think that's just because I happen to enjoy smiling a lot. I'm not the sort of person who would present myself in everyday life as somebody who comes across as like stern or like with a stick up my ass. If that's how you present yourself in everyday life,
famous bitch,
then go for it.
Yeah.
You're your own person. But I think just as much as I don't really like to admit this, I think that the sort of person that I am is more palatable to broader society. And I kind of hate that a little bit.
Well,
but
you know what? That's just who you are. And the issue isn't that you are smiling. The issue would be that if you were having a bad day, which everybody does.
Oh, I've had some bad days recently.
And men came along and went, hey, smile more. That's the issue.
Absolutely not.
Like, it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't matter what they're saying. It's the fact that they're just like
Trying to dictate
my behavior. How you present.
And I suppose I am privileged to some degree in that the way that I feel comfortable going through the world and the way that I feel comfortable presenting myself is a more palatable version of what it is to be a woman.
Yeah.
And, like, add into that, you know, white supremacy and heteronormativity on top of that, but that everyone should be as free to walk through the world being true to themselves as I am currently.
Mm. And I think part of the reason that the rest of the cast kind of paint Kat as this... what's the phrase that the...
Heinous bitch.
Heinous bitch.
Yes.
Which I love that Kat wears that as a badge of honor.
Yeah.
Like the Allison Janney as the guidance counselor is phenomenal.
No, I think
phenomenal.
She's the principal.
No, she's like a guidance counselor or something.
I thought, but then why is everyone getting sent to her for misbehaving?
Because they need guidance.
I thought she was the principal.
All right, I'm looking this up. Allison Janney, Padua High School's guidance counselor and a writer of erotic fiction.
I love that. I also like how, I mean, I know it is funny because she like gets, like stops disciplining children and like goes back to writing her erotic novel. Like it's funny just because of the juxtaposition of that. Mm. But I also like how no one is like, ew, pornographic fiction.
She has such a healthy sexuality. It's yeah. really just kind of normalized.
Yeah, like, and everyone okay. knows about it.
Yeah. In fact, students start pitching her bits.
Yeah. And she like calls her secretary or assistant to be like, what's another word for pulsating or yeah. something to that effect? Yeah. Normalizing women expressing their sexuality. And also phenomenal. Doing it in a comedic way because it's Allison Janney and she's fantastic.
She's phenomenal. Anyway, part of the reason that I think Kat presents herself in such a standoffish way is, again, she's kind of going against conformity and doing things just for the sake of everybody else doing it. And when everybody is saying, oh, she's such a bitch and oh, she's so mean and stuff, well, of course she's going to fight against that. And double down on her.
She's like, yes, it's working.
Yeah, phenomenal. This is exactly what I want.
Mm. And I think it's nice that it's almost like, I think we have a long way to go in taking back the word bitch and it not being used in a vitriolic way against women. I mean, I refer to myself in third person as bitch all the time. Like, initially, when I was very into my boyfriend before he was my boyfriend, and everyone was very aware of it, especially him, I refer to that period of the pre-relationship. I refer to myself in that time as bitch not subtle.
She was not subtle.
Oh, bitch was not subtle.
The stories that I've been told, and I'm just like, how did either of you question this for a second?
Anyway, but I like that this is a really seemingly early example of somebody like wearing the word bitch as a bit of a badge of honor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I very actively in my day-to-day life will... pull myself up if I go to purposefully call another woman a bitch in its like original meaning. I'm like, no. I'll find another word that is not gendered.
Yeah, and more specific to the individual.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's just take back the word bitch.
Yeah, take them all back.
I mean, I think the queer community are doing that as well.
Yeah. It's evolving and being reclaimed, which is phenomenal.
I love the reclamation of words.
Yeah. I want to talk about Mr. Morgan.
Who is that, Ellis? Because I don't think we ever hear his name. we just saw that in the IMDb credits.
He's the English teacher.
Yes.
And there's a scene in his classroom very early on that establishes Kat's character. And also establishes the perception around her, where it's English class, there's Kat, there's Joey, who's a dick. And there's Mr. Morgan, who is an African-American man, and he's very exasperated at having to teach all of these kids English. And Kat raises an issue. They're discussing Ernest Hemingway, and Kat raises the fact that he was a drunken
misogynistic white man.
And takes issue with the fact that why aren't we studying more female writers?
Sylvia Plath.
And Charlotte Bronte.
Yeah.
And Joey kind of goes, oh, feminism, blah, blah, blah. Almost exact word-for-word dialogue.
Yeah. You nailed it.
And Mr. Morgan kind of, like, clamps down and is just like, Joey, shut up. You're an idiot. I think he even says, like, she could punch you in the face and I wouldn't do anything to stop it because you're so annoying. But then he turns to Kat and he says, he I think, has a point when he points out the fact that she's a very privileged, upper-middle-class white woman. And there's no black writers on the curriculum. And he has to get up, stand up here and talk about Ernest Hemingway and Shakespeare, and he doesn't get to honor black artists and black lives, and kind of, like, raises the idea of, quote-unquote, white feminism.
Yeah, like, he doesn't specifically say it like that, but that's no. what he's critiquing in her, yeah.
And I think I can't imagine what the discourse was like in 1999, but I imagine that might have been a very nuanced take to say, hey, even though you are disenfranchised as a woman in a patriarchal society, maybe understand that you carry other privileges with you that people of color don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a really fascinating scene to set up. To not only kind of say, here is our character and all the things that she stands for, we're going to immediately raise this other political issue and just be like, just be aware that this is a thing.
Yeah. I think there's so much packed into this scene. It's literally the first scene. And when Alice and I watched it yesterday, we paused it and we're like, there's a lot to unpack there. We like had there's a 5-minute discussion after it. And while I think that those points are really important... Mm-hmm. And especially in modern day, there is no excuse to not be an intersectional activist.
Yes.
And so I think raising those points in the 90s was absolutely valid and important. But what I don't like about this scene is that it feels like the person standing up for feminism and the person standing up for black lives are pitted against one another.
It's kind of aggressive and they're butting heads.
Yeah. And I also don't like the fact that he kind of shoots her down for having a lot of opinions because like he's like, yes, yes, miss, I have an opinion on everything. What's up? And so even though he's trying to some degree, like, stick up for the marginalized group that he belongs to, he's also shooting down another one, and vice versa. Like,
I think he does say that he agrees with her, but also, what about this issue?
Yeah.
And it kind of, it does turn it into a little bit of, like, whataboutism.
Yeah.
And I think you put it really well in saying that if this film came out in 2020, there's no way they'd be on opposite sides.
I don't think so. I think that, I think... Something, intersectionality is really important for a number of reasons, like especially around making feminism accessible for people that are oppressed in other ways other than through their gender. But I think that another thing that intersectionality teaches us is that almost all marginalized groups are fighting against the same system.
Yeah.
And so in this instance, it's like Kat takes issue with Joey, this gross, entitled, misogynistic white man. This guy takes issue with Joey because he's, for the same reasons, but also he's just hella annoying. but they're butting heads with one another when it's actually like, okay, why are they all misogynistic white men? Like, that's the issue, that it's whiteness and masculinity that are platformed above everyone else. Like, if we kind of bandied together, we could get more, like, black women writers in the curriculum. So I think that intersectionality teaches us that there is a lot of overlap between patriarchy and white supremacy and ableism, heteronormativity, and homophobia. So, yeah, I think that... I don't like the fact that the pro-black lives and the pro-feminism discussions in this conversation are made out to be against one another. I don't like that these characters butt heads and that he kind of puts her down for being opinionated because even though, yes, he's trying to stand up for black lives, he's also being sexist in the process.
Yeah, it's
Yeah. He's like, oh, no, an opinionated woman. Shut up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, while I do think that the scene makes some good points, I think that it's also problematic in other ways.
And I wonder if that's just a product of its time. Like,
yeah.
Is that just how discourse existed in the late 90s? Is it a narrative device because, like, well, we need to establish that Kat is at odds with everyone?
Mm. Even, like, the activist teachers?
Yeah. So, like, I wonder what the reasoning is for that. I think it's a problematic scene, but it's a very good scene.
It's very funny.
It's really funny.
Mostly that every 2 seconds somebody tells Joey to shut up.
Yeah.
Like,
it's so satisfying.
Yeah.
It's
literally my favorite shot of the whole movie is the aerial shot coming up above the gym floor where you see Joey just writhing in pain because he's just been kicked in the balls. It's outstanding.
It's wonderful. And we will get to that. I think we should bring up his assault.
Joey.
Because it's so satisfying to relive. I do also think that is the only time that the film addresses racial issues as
yes.
well. Like, I feel like it makes a very strong start.
Yeah.
And then doesn't really finish the race. Mm. Pardon the pun.
Oh, that was bad, Ellis.
That was really bad. I might cut that.
Part of me also, like, wonders whether the two white female writers were trying to be, like, a bit self-aware at that point.
Yeah.
Like, whether they were trying to acknowledge their own privilege in that scene.
Yeah,
to be
maybe.
Like, yes, we are trying to fight for the representation of women, but also we evidently have a lot of privilege as well.
But, like, it never really does anything with that self-aware. It's like, we're aware, we're not really doing anything about it.
We're aware, and then the rest of the cast are going to be white, and then there's going to be one token black character elsewhere who doesn't really do anything.
Yeah, Chastity is a real black best friend trope.
Ooh, yeah.
Chastity, who...
played by Gabrielle Union.
Gabrielle Union.
Who we all know and love, well, I mean, I do at least, from Bring It On, the first movie, as the head cheerleader of the Clovers.
Yeah, I haven't seen Bring It On. Yeah. I really need to.
It's cold in here. There must be some clovers in the atmosphere. Ellis, we need to have a future episode on Bring It On just so I can educate you.
We definitely do.
It's a very important movie. But this was right before Bring It On, so this was like almost potentially Gabrielle Union's also entry into the industry.
But it is a shame to see that the kind of... is a very clear-cut example of the black best friend trope where, like, everyone around her is white and she kind of only exists to be a talking sounding board for the white character's ideas.
And also, I think having... I mean, I'm not super educated on this, but one point that I have seen about this trope, the black best friend trope, is that it's, on surface level, it's like, oh, look, we've got black actors in our movies, so we're inclusive. Like, it's sort of for show, but then you dive in, you're like, what does this character do? She's a sounding board for what's the sister's name?
Bianca.
And then she double-crosses her.
Yeah, it's quite a shallow portrayal. We know very little about her as a person.
And also, when Joey gets blown off by Bianca, she's like the second option.
And she's like, yeah, I'll go with you.
Yeah.
I'll do the thing. You can take me to prom.
Yeah. Also, Chastity has got to be the worst name that you can give your child. It's like, hello, daughter who has just been born. You know what? I think that I'd like to let you know from the get-go that I will be controlling your sex life through this name that I'm giving you. You'll be chaste.
And if you don't like it, you can talk to your brother, abstinence only.
No. No, the brother's name is like...
Get him, sport.
Something like that.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Actually, that's a really good segue. Let's talk about Kat and Bianca's father.
Let us.
Who, he's played by Larry Miller, who if you followed along, you know he was the shopkeeper in Pretty Woman.
One Pretty Woman, Ellis. We went through this in our Pretty Woman episode as well. Singular.
Pretty Woman.
Yes. Correct.
Woman. He plays their very overprotective father. Their mother walked out on them at some point, so he's raising them on his own. Mm. He, I think he's a OBGYN?
I think so, yeah.
He helps a lot of people give birth as a doctor.
Yes,
as...
he was up to his elbow in placenta. Like, what a great line.
It's a great line. But he comes across as very controlling and domineering, and he's the one that kind of sets the plot in motion because he has the rule that Bianca isn't allowed to date anybody until Kat dates anybody.
Yes.
And because he's like, oh, Kat's so antisocial and hates everybody, there's no way anyone would she'd want to date anyone.
And then
so,
that sets in motion the shenanigans that Joseph Gordon-Levitt is like, all right, we're going to, with the help of my buddy Michael here, who is like an absolute star, I'm going to rave about how much I love that character later, but with help of my new bud, we're going to find somebody who is willing to date Kat so that I can date Bianca.
Enter Heath Ledger.
Oh!
Shenanigans ensue.
Shenanigans ensue. Shakespeare.
There's a big misunderstanding. And...
it was, like, going really well, and then I said to Ellis, like, it's got to all blow up soon, right? Yeah. Like, there's, it's all got to go completely wrong.
Crumbling down.
Eventually.
And then it did. And, oh, man, this movie just makes me happy. But our issue with the father is he is so controlling of his daughter's lives. Like, he doesn't really give them any agency.
I'm going to find some choice phrases I wrote down.
Yeah.
I wrote down a few key quotes that I was like, oof.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
But the fact that he is so strict on keeping them from getting pregnant, I think, is the main thing.
How can I sleep when my daughters are out there getting impregnated? I believe was... okay, so a choice interaction. Kat says to him, stop making decisions for me. And he says, I'm your father. That's my right.
Mm.
No.
He's very much a kind of patriarchal head of the household type thing. And one could make the argument that he's coming from a place of, I am a single parent. I'm worried about my daughters and their future. But he
it goes
also,
too far.
It goes too far. And he doesn't realize that they are their own individuals with their own choices and their own decisions to make. And
I do, though, think that in the portrayal of this character, he's a comedic character.
Yeah.
Like, the stuff that he says is so ridiculous that it's funny. And because, A, he's a comedic character, and also, B, there are a few moments where you're like, oh, you're such a dork. Like, he's sitting in front of the TV watching this commercial about spray-on hair, and he's, like, looking at it with interest. Like, he's not set up to be a character whose opinion you respect.
Yeah.
And so I think that... I do think that that character is actually genuinely a critique of the things that he's saying and what he stands for, this real... overbearing control of his daughters and their choices and their respective sexualities.
Mm-hmm. I think it also does, the film does a really good job at subtly demonstrating how harmful that kind of mentality can be to his daughters, not in the obvious kind of you're locked in the house and you can't touch boys kind of way, or whoever you want to touch. But the fact that Kat makes a bunch of decisions trying to protect Bianca from Joey.
Mm.
And Bianca points out the fact and is like, well, you took away my ability or my agency to make a mistake and to learn something and to make my own choice.
Mm.
Kat inadvertently doing the exact same thing that their father was doing to them.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that's exactly it. Like, as well as teaching your daughters that they don't have any agency, it means that you don't get an opportunity to mess up and then learn from your mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think that the really overbearing parent, the overbearing, I'm your father, so I make your decisions and you answer to me, just sets you up to then, if you go into a heterosexual marriage, mm-hmm. be like, okay, well, I answer to the man in my life.
Yeah.
I am at his will. He controls me and my choices. So we don't love it.
No.
Yeah. So moral of the story, fathers, please know that your daughters can make their own decisions and are in control of their own lives.
And if you have educated them as well-rounded people, you should be secure knowing that they will probably make a good decision.
Yeah. Just, yeah. It goes back to Spring Awakening.
Yep.
Arm them with the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can make educated choices from there.
Exactly.
I don't know how we have gone this long without truly diving in to the joy that is Heath Ledger and his character in this movie. I love him dearly. Rest in peace, Heath Ledger. We miss you.
He's so
beautiful.
Beautiful.
But not just physically.
No. He's a beautiful person with mm-hmm. a beautiful soul.
Yes.
And I think it's kind of cool that he and Kat go through very similar ways of growth.
Mm.
In that they both start out outcasts
mm-hmm.
who have put up this very defensive wall.
And who everyone around them has a very strong opinion and perception of.
Mm-hmm. Can't go near them. He's going to drill my French book. Which he does.
Well, he did do that.
But that's part of his defensive persona.
Yeah.
In kind of like keeping everybody away. And it's only by him and Kat getting to know each other, albeit through the shenanigans-inspired circumstances of him being paid to date her.
Yeah.
They get to know each other, and they start realizing that maybe being defensive isn't what makes me happy anymore.
Mm.
And, you know, they bond and they unify, and you get to see these really beautiful glimpses of the lovely heart that rests in Patrick. There's a moment, there's the big party, and Kat has gotten way too drunk, and he's trying to take care of her and, like, get her somewhere safe so that she can, you know, recuperate and not letting her fall asleep because she might have a concussion.
And just keeps catching her?
Yeah, it's
another amazing physical visual gag.
Oh, it's wonderful. Julia Stiles falling off the swing is
outstanding.
Brilliant. But there's a moment in between all that where baby Joseph Gordon-Levitt comes up and he's like, the thing's off, Bianca doesn't want me, it's done. And he gives this really quick, inspirational speech that isn't, don't take no for an answer, you pursue that woman regardless of what she says.
Which it could have so easily devolved into.
He's just like, you are a good person, you have a good heart, you are twice the person that Joey is, he's a vapid idiot, and you are so much more than that. Just be yourself and show that to her, and if she likes it, she'll like it.
Mm. Oh, and then he catches Julia Stiles.
And then he catches Julia Stiles and takes her away. And it's this beautiful moment. And it kind of caught me off guard. Like, obviously, I'm like, oh, he can't be the hard ass that he's portraying because that's the way the movies work. But this was a real moment of, like, sincerity. And sincerity between two men about, like, a very kind of, like, emotional thing really took me by surprise. And really, like, I was like, if I wasn't in love with Heath Ledger before, I was at that moment. Like, it was like, that was it.
Yeah. And then he takes home drunk Julia Stiles. She tries to kiss him, and he's like, nah, you're drunk. I'm not going to kiss you.
Yeah.
A round of applause.
It's just beautiful.
Yeah. Although, that being said, I'm making a big deal of that. It should be the standard. Like, that should be the expectation.
Yeah,
it shouldn't be an applaudable action.
It really, really shouldn't.
But unfortunately, we still, in 2020, live in a society where that is less common than it should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But very, very a good tool that the movie uses to showcase that he's actually a good person.
He's a good dude. And then... let's talk about everything blowing up. So she discovers that Joey has been paying him to go out with her because He's also in on the thing that he wants to date Bianca, even though that's all been facilitated by Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
There's so many shenanigans in this movie.
So many shenanigans.
It's very Shakespeare.
But Julia Stiles finds out that Patrick is being paid.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, feels incredibly betrayed, as she has every right to.
Mm-hmm.
And then does this moving soliloquy, if you will. No, it's not a soliloquy because she has audience members. Monologue.
Poetry reading.
Yeah. About how she is hurt by him, but also that she still has feelings for him, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets her this Fender guitar that she'd seen her like wanting because she like wants to start a badass punk girl band.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming it's a girl band. We don't see any other band members, but I think that's a fair assumption.
Yeah.
And then I still feel a little bit dicey about this, but she like sees the guitar and it's sort of like a moment of forgiveness. But then she also is like, you know, you can't just buy me a guitar every time you screw up. Which is great. It shows that she's not compromising her values too much.
But then Heath Ledger replies with, yeah, no, I'm aware of that, but there's also a drum kit and a bass and maybe even a tambourine. And my heart was just like, take me, Heath, I am yours.
But I do think that the nice sentiment is that he used the money that he was given from Joey to buy the guitar. So it's not mm-hmm. like he was still benefiting financially. Like, he was taking the money that had been received by him in dubious circumstances, and then she's the beneficiary of that. So yeah. I think that that is a nice transactional moment of redemption.
I also think it's very obvious that it's a very personal gift.
Mm.
It shows that he understands her and listens to her and like wants to support her and her dreams and her endeavors. It's not just a big flashy gift for the sake of it.
It's no flowers being delivered by doves, a la Enchanted.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
I do feel like the ending is a little rushed. Like, I wonder if there were a couple more scenes in the script that were taken out for whatever reason.
Yeah, it does conclude very quickly.
Yeah, which, you know, no movie's perfect.
Yeah. I expected there to be more scenes in between of both of them being sad that it had ended. I was like, where's the montage? Where's the montage with the sad music in the background?
Yeah. But
also I still loved it.
It still works as an ending, and I think it works because it's true to both of the characters. He showcases that he is a caring individual and supportive individual, and she is uncompromising in her beliefs, but still like going, "Well, I still like you and I still care about you and I don't want to have these walls up between us."
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't just give me a thing and you're okay. Yeah. You have to make changes.
Yeah.
Stop getting paid to date me, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think that one of my favorite things about this movie is the fact that most of the characters are quite multidimensional.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the characters, most of the core cast are very multidimensional, and you see their flaws alongside their redeeming qualities.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that about it. Something that kind of jarred me a little bit is the fact that Julia Stiles is kind of is angry at Heath Ledger. I know that they have character names, but yeah, that went out the window a while ago.
Yeah.
After he doesn't kiss her, even though from a feminist standpoint that was the right thing to do on his part, mm-hmm. But then you sit back and you're like, she's a teenager, she's embarrassed, like she
put herself out
she put herself out there and she went for someone and it wasn't reciprocated, like mm-hmm. of course that's gonna sting regardless of whether what they were doing was actually the right call. So like you see that even though she's got these really strong morals, she still is flawed.
Yeah.
But also she's very endearing, I think.
Oh, very endearing. Like, I love Kat as a character.
Mm.
I love Patrick. I love, like, all of the characters are really lovely. Like you were saying, Michael.
Oh, Michael.
Who is, like, the nerdy best friend to baby Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And he could have so easily been just this annoying, kind of nerdy, constantly horny.
Why would nobody sleep with me, that guy?
Yeah, but he's very charming, and he's very funny, and when he is pursuing or courting...
very Shakespearean.
Appropriate. A lovely woman. He isn't just, like, hitting on them for a quick fling and then moving on. It seems like he really cares about Julia Stiles' best friend who rocks up, like, halfway through the movie.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a random addition. But, like, I like her.
She's cool. She's very, very charming. She likes Shakespeare. That's her thing. And so...
Very meta.
Michael starts to woo her by, like, learning more about Shakespeare and engaging with her interests, and he invites her to the prom by giving her an old-fashioned Shakespearean dress, and he rocks up dressed the way that Shakespeare would have, and it's really wholesome and lovely. It's
very wholesome. Also, the dad has redeeming qualities.
Yeah.
Like, by the end of it, he's like, I know that I was really resistant to you going to college in another state, but, like, I've already... pay the first installment, so you're going.
Yeah.
Like, you can see, even though all of the stuff that he's done up to this point has been really problematic, you can see what's underpinning that, mm-hmm. the fact that, you know, this burden of single fatherhood, etc. I think that Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, whose name is Cameron, I was going to say that, I think that he has a couple of dicey moments in that... It seems like he felt quite entitled to Bianca because he's like, I learned French for you and other things, but that was the main one that stuck in my head.
Yeah.
But also he genuinely cares about her and yeah.
And let's talk about Bianca because I don't think we've not really. She starts out as quite a self-centered person. She
loves her Prada backpack.
She loves her Prada backpack. And the only reason that Chastity doesn't is because Chastity doesn't have a Prada backpack.
Love that. just flex your white privilege there, Bianca.
Yeah. But she has a moment halfway through where she kind of realizes that, oh, I have been... She was manipulating Cameron to get with Joey, and she kind of has a very bad experience with Joey at the party where he's very self-absorbed and self-centered, and she's kind of like, oh, I actually don't want this. And she kind of realizes that maybe she has been a bit self-centered and selfish. And then from that point, she starts to grow and change, and she becomes more open to the idea of getting to know Cameron, of getting to know her sister and understanding her sister. She starts kind of standing up for herself in a way that she hadn't really before.
She punches Joey in the face!
Oh, it's so beautiful. I had forgotten...
So much poetic justice in
I'd
that
I'd forgotten
scene.
How that scene went, and I was ready for either Joseph Gordon-Levitt to punch Joey or Heath Ledger to punch Joey.
Or Kat to punch Joey.
Yeah.
No, it's Bianca.
Taking control of herself and just being like, I am not putting up with your shit anymore. Oh, yeah, Joey's trying to sleep with Bianca because he made a bet with a friend. And Bianca finds this out, and she's just like, you know what? I'm going to punch you in the face.
Correct.
And it's one of the most satisfying punches in cinema history.
And then there's the aerial shot of him writhing on the floor.
It's wonderful.
Oh. It's very satisfying in that you've hated him all film and he actually genuinely gets his comeuppance.
Yeah. Like,
that's fantastic.
And the fact that it was Bianca to deliver that comeuppance was so wonderful and a really nice way to complete that arc. And it's just... She didn't need anybody to come to her rescue.
No. She's taking her life into her own hands.
Yes. Oh, it was so, so good.
And I like that Bianca kind of, at the beginning, kind of stands for Hello, I'm here to represent the popular high school girl. I fulfill all of your beauty standards, and I fulfill appealing to the male gaze. And yes, hello, I am here to represent everything that is peaking in high school.
Yeah.
And then she kind of, she develops into so much more than that.
Yeah.
And that's really satisfying.
It is.
I think there are so many satisfying things about this film. I think that everything is kind of tied up. Like, it doesn't leave you hanging on any point, but also each of the moments of things kind of coming to a nice, lovely conclusion don't feel, like, overly contrived.
No.
Like, of course they're contrived because it's a 90s rom-com, but none of it is like, oh, yeah, of course, yeah, and you got together because, yeah, of course you did.
Like, throughout the whole film, we see Kat and Patrick's relationship growing. We see Bianca and Cameron's relationship growing.
Yeah.
We
see the relationship between Kat and Bianca growing.
Yeah.
And their respective relationships with their dad.
Mm-hmm. And same with Patrick and Cam and Michael.
Mike,
and even the side characters of Michael and the Shakespeare girl. Like, they are kind of just like, they are paired up, but their relationship is still given a little bit of time.
Yeah, it's not like, oh, yeah, we've got these two characters left over, let's just chuck them together.
Exactly.
It actually genuinely feels like there's some thought that's gone into
that.
It's not like, oh, we got some loose ends that we've got to tie up conveniently. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, I mean, that's probably what, well, actually, no, it's probably just in the original text.
Yeah, because, I mean, Shakespeare, everybody ends up with everybody.
Of course.
That's just the way it works.
Of course. It's a comedy.
Good on you, Shakespeare.
Very satisfying.
If Shakespeare has contributed nothing else to culture, he gave us the basis for 10 Things I Hate About You.
I think you'd be very hard pressed to suggest that that's all that Shakespeare has contributed to culture, Ellis.
Maybe.
Hot take.
Maybe. Mim.
Yes, Ellis.
Does 10 Things I Hate About You pass the Bechdel test?
I was thinking about this. I reckon it does.
Yep.
First thing that comes to mind is the scene between Bianca and Kat where they're talking about their mum's pearls.
Yep.
The scene between Bianca and Chastity where they're talking about the Prada backpack. Like, technically.
Technically.
That doesn't have to be a feminist conversation to pass the Bechdel test. But also, if you're a feminist and you like your Prada backpack, like...
Go for it.
Go for it. Like what you like.
Mm-hmm. We also... There's a conversation between Alice and Janie and Kat about Kat's kind of misbehavior.
Being called a heinous bitch.
Yes.
Yeah.
That scene. And also her giving suggestions for the... the erotic novel.
Oh, iconic.
So there's quite a few.
Yeah, it does. Ellis, do we rate or ruin 10 Things I Hate About You?
As a feminist work?
Yeah.
I rate it.
Me too.
I rate it. I think it's really... It, like, kind of... Your main character is a hardcore feminist who doesn't...
Compromise
her ideals.
I think, hot take, if this wasn't written by two women who... I'm going to guess are pretty phenomenal because they wrote both this and Legally Blonde. Thank you for bringing them into our lives. I think that if it weren't written by two women, it might have fallen into the trap of, oh, I'll give up being a feminist and a hardcore, raging, strong-willed bitch for this man
who's come to
change
more.
Me. And I like that that doesn't happen.
Yeah. It could have very easily been a Grease-style ending.
Mm.
And it was not. So that's how I read it from a feminist perspective.
Also from a good movie perspective?
It's phenomenal.
The interesting thing is, like, I've definitely seen this movie before, but I couldn't remember whether A... it had good gender politics, or B, if I even liked it.
Mm.
And we watched it yesterday, and I was so blown away by how much I liked it from both of those standpoints. Like, we had a great time watching it.
It's so funny. It's really heartfelt. It's so well acted. It's really well shot. I think this was the director's first film as well, which I was taken aback by. I'm like, it was quite well directed. Has, like, one of the best credit songs ever with I Want You to Want Me in that huge crane shot where they're performing on top of the school. I was just like, this movie is iconic for a reason.
Yeah. I do think it could do better with regards to the representation of black people and people of color.
Yeah.
I think it falls short in that regard.
There's no queer representation.
No.
But they do make reference to... They hypothesize that perhaps Kat isn't straight.
Yeah.
And what's the phrase that they use?
She's, Bianca says, oh, I found a photo of Jared Leto in her drawer once, so she's not same-sex attracted.
Which felt like a somewhat respectful way to
yeah.
say that. They could have easily thrown around a slur.
Yeah.
There are a couple of slurs that are thrown around in a 90s that was the way, like the ableist R-word slur
yeah.
is used a couple yeah. of times.
Yucky.
Don't
use that word, pals.
Don't. But in the 90s, apparently, that was okay.
Yeah. But going back to the Jared Leto same-sex attracted thing, you can be attracted, like, as a woman, you can be attracted to men and still be same-sex attracted.
Yes.
But it, sexuality is not binary.
Yeah. It was very...
Let's not contribute to bi erasure.
Exactly. More bi representation, please.
Please.
Please. But this film is really good. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. If you have seen it, watch it again.
Go watch it again.
It's real good.
Ellis, if our pals want to get in touch with us to tell us how much they also loved 10 Things I Hate About You and its gender politics, or if they want to disagree with us, feel free to disagree. These are only our opinions. How can they do so?
Well, first they can organize for the school marching band to perform Can't Take My Eyes Off of You in the football field.
Yeah.
Or...
And then sing their opinions.
And then sing their opinions
from
to
the stands.
Us. I disagree with you, but I respect your right to have opinions that don't align with mine.
That was outstanding. I am genuinely impressed with that you came up with that parody on the spot.
Why don't I do more improv?
I don't know, Ellis. You should. You're a great lyricist.
Please find us on Facebook.
Please
we
do.
Are Feminism Ruins Everything - It's a Feminist Podcast.
It is a feminist podcast.
Or you can find us on Instagram @ Feminism Ruins Everything Pod. Or you could support us on Patreon and hear all of the bloopers that we cut out of this episode.
Yes.
See our cover art a bit early. Find us on patreon.com/ Feminism Ruins Everything Pod.
Get in touch, pals.
Yeah.
Tell us what other movies, musicals, pop culture phenomena you would like to hear us cover. We really value your input.
At this point, I really want to, like, cut to the cover of I Want You to Want Me that plays in the film, and that be our credits music, but we don't have the rights to that.
We
so.
Don't. Oh, maybe if it was, like, a short enough clip.
Oh, maybe.
I don't know. We'll check with Acro.
Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, pal. See you next week. Bye.